Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. You can support this local independent media by visiting the KBOO website at kboo.fm and clicking on the red Donate tab. I'm Fran Michelle, and I'm your host for today's Old Mole, which looks at America at war. Right now, we are living in wartime. As one of our guests today points out, the United States military is active in at least 5 different war zones. In addition to maintaining over 700 military bases in nearly 100 countries, the U.S. military is busy engaging in special forces operations and training operations and sending troops and ships and weapons, so many weapons. All this death is fostered by and fostering the interests of capital and of U.S. politicians, ramping up militarized policing, racist violence and incarceration, and increases in the wealth of investment markets, along with driving down needed public investments in things like public education, public housing, and public health. The state of public health today is such that you might not know that the COVID-19 pandemic continues, but it does, and we are currently in a major surge of infections. I have the receipts. You can find links to sources for this information on the KBOO webpage for this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour. You might not know that COVID is not a mild respiratory illness, but instead is a vascular disease that damages most organ systems in the body, often causing lingering symptoms and sometimes causing long-term disability, even in previously healthy young people. You might not know that it kills someone outright about every 15 minutes in the USA and contributes significantly to other causes of death, including cancer, heart disease and stroke, diabetes, dementia, depression, and motor vehicle accidents. You might not know that about a third of cases show no symptoms but can still cause bodily harm, that people without symptoms can infect others, and that you can get COVID repeatedly, and the damage adds up. You might not know that vaccination is helpful, but the virus evolves very rapidly and immunity wanes very quickly. You might not know that universal masking policies and improved ventilation help a lot. Wearing a tightly fitted high filtration mask, if you can do so, shows that you care about protecting yourself, your loved ones, and your community. Anyone can suffer from COVID and its potentially debilitating, disabling, and deadly consequences, but the danger and the damage are greater among those more frequently exposed and those already suffering other stresses, including poor people, people of color, queer people, and those who are houseless or incarcerated. Of course, extreme stress is suffered by those under military attack. In our first segment today, I talk with Ramona Escayo and Shyam Geith about their zine, Mask Up, We Need You, Palestinian Solidarity, COVID-19, and the Struggle for Liberation, about the COVID-19 pandemic as both a genocide and a tool of genocide, about the cumulative dangers and disparate impacts of the continuing pandemic, and about their work to share information and resources. Then, Laurie Mercier interviews historian Osama Khalil about his new book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden. They discuss how U.S. governments have turned from trying to end violent conflicts to instead trying to manage them for the political and economic gain of the ruling class. For those who are looking to connect with others about war and pestilence, the 39th Veterans for Peace National Convention is being held online this week, Friday through Sunday, August 16 to 18. This year's theme is Ceasefire Now, Demilitarize and Decolonize, with a strong focus on responses to events in Palestine, including from Israeli and U.S. conscientious objectors and refusers of military service, as well as from Freedom Flotilla participants and others working to end the military occupation and colonization of Gaza. The program also includes activists seeking justice for victims of U.S. wars, trying to address the effects of war and militarism on climate, advocating repatriation of deported U.S. veterans, and seeking to prevent further privatization and weakening of VA care for veterans. Aside from the membership meeting, the convention is open to non-members for peace, whether or not they are veterans. You can find more information and register at vfpconvention.org. That site is also linked on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you'll be able to find the podcast of this episode and more information about its segments, as well as links to subscribe or contact us, and of course, to support KBOO. We turn now to my conversation with the creators of Mask Up, We Need You, about the damage done in Gaza by the Israeli occupation force, the IOF, and the damage done by disease. Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Ramona Escayo and Shayam Geith, co-creators of the zine Mask Up, We Need You, Palestinian Solidarity, COVID-19, and the Struggle for Liberation. Both are writers and designers. Shayam worked for several years as a news reporter for Associated Press and other outlets, and more recently in the art department for several well-known series, Rami, Orange is the New Black, The Americans, and produced and co-directed the award-winning Amazon web series Brothers, about a group of trans mask friends, and is currently on the steering committee of Swana Rose PDX. Ramona is also a writer, designer, and illustrator, including work with Bridge City Media, as well as the book I'm Having Top Surgery, An Illustrated Guide for You and Me. The book release was covered on KBOO's Trans Positive PDX, and they have created zines on trans healthcare and COVID as a labor issue, as well as one on how to make propaganda, another collaboration with Shyam. So the zine Mask Up, We Need You, Palestinian Solidarity, COVID-19, and the Struggle for Liberation, is explained as a primer for those who consider themselves co-strugglers for Palestinian liberation, yet may not understand the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic as both a genocide in itself and a tool of genocide that perpetuates all others. So let me ask you to unpack that. How did you come to develop the zine?
Yeah, that's a great question. We've been kind of co-creating and thinking about COVID, trying to survive this pandemic together. And this is sort of a sequel project, I would say, for our first zine, which is called COVID is a Labor Issue. And that was a zine that I wrote and Shayam illustrated. And we came up with these ideas together as two workers whose unions were in labor struggles at the time. And just thinking about how do we get workers to connect the dots between our struggles as workers and our international struggles as workers and the ongoing pandemic, which is putting our lives at risk and impacting our daily lives. So after October 7th and the genocide really escalating in Gaza and Palestine, we were thinking about how do we continue to draw those connections and get people to think about COVID more globally and see how the IOF are using disease as a tool of genocide. And that just comes right back to this settler colony that we are existing in and how this settler colony has always used disease as a tool of genocide, going back to smallpox that has devastated indigenous people here and continues. Those impacts continue.
That's a really great way to put it. As you mentioned, this is a sequel. We've been collaborating and trying to survive, as you said, through this pandemic together. And we both use our social media platforms mostly for advocacy. We're drawing attention to issues that we need to be talking about that, you know, maybe we don't see other people talking about quite as much. And as we're both artists and creators ourselves, and I think both scenes, but this one in particular, one morning, Ramona had responded to some comment on, you know, Instagram, and that literally turned into the zine. Like, Mo wrote an entire zine based from this one comment that really just was laying out what people need to be thinking about and taking into account. And I think I put together like 10 slides on the same day. And I was like, okay, we made this zine. And Mo was like, no, I was thinking something a little bigger. So now we have 40 pages, 40 pages of really extensively researched. And we have a community of collaborators and organizers who have been helping us with everything we do. But this really turned into a multiple month endeavor that we just released, and which already, unfortunately, is almost outdated, at least, you know, numbers wise, since there have been no mitigating efforts in the meantime, since we just released this.
One of the notable things about the Palestinian solidarity movement has been people are masking more there, are wearing respirator masks more at pro-Palestinian anti-genocide events than in ordinary daily life, as far as I can tell. And it seems like there's been a lot of education to get to that point, to help people understand that. So that's a place where people have been, I guess, particularly receptive to hearing this information about COVID-19.
Yeah, I think something that has been a big driving factor, motivation behind this project is here we have global uprising for Palestine, and simultaneously we have a pandemic. Folks in this settler colony are drawing attention to violence that's happening, you know, some might say, quote, a world away. But it's really like, how are we making the things that are invisible in our daily lives, perhaps, visible? And, you know, as artists, as activists, how do we not think about struggles as singular? But as this scene really says, like, if you think about any struggle, COVID is just intertwined in that. You know, disability justice is intertwined in that. Where I would say folks are noticing that people are taking to the streets for Palestine with masks on, and we owe everything to the disabled activists who are making that happen and the people behind the scenes who are making that happen. The scene is an invitation for organizers to up their precautions, and not just at the protests, but in our daily lives and in our social lives. And just as the call for Palestinian solidarity is, that's not something that just takes place on the street. That's also boycott, divest, sanctions. We're thinking about the struggle as intertwined with our daily lives. And COVID is such a reminder of that, and is that same kind of daily militant practice.
Was part of the impetus for this the sense that people weren't making connections or didn't understand the gravity of COVID-19? Because there's certainly been a lot of propaganda suggesting it's mild, it's nothing. Has that been something that you've been working to respond to and having to overcome?
For sure. I think we're up against a major propaganda machine that has lulled all of us in many ways to all of the mass death that we are trying to bring attention to, that we're trying to protest. Mass death here on this continent, mass death that we are exporting across the globe. So part of the impetus for the zine was to bring in our co-organizers and our, you know, and our comrades to help make those connections that we all can see. Like, we don't trust the US government about this, do we? So why would we trust this propaganda about this? We need to educate as best we can, as we can. This is kind of what, you know, Ramona and I and the people, the amazing people that we work with and collaborate with and learn from are trying to do. It's a huge propaganda machine that unfortunately has its tendrils sort of all over. I sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it is true that, you know, I personally, having worked as a journalist and having worked for the film industry and the television industry, I can understand from inside these machines how it's a concerted effort across the globe to sort of export this facade of what is happening on a world stage, when really that's not the case. So we're absolutely up against a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and that's what we spend a lot of our time doing.
And would you say that the sort of shared motivations for both the minimization of the pandemic and the
propaganda around what's happening in Palestine is, broadly speaking, the interests of capitalist settler colonialism. Take off the mask, go shopping, clear this territory, sell some real estate, drill some oil.
Literally. It's a land grab. It's a money grab. It's putting profits absolutely before people, absolutely before humans. And I mean, we definitely go into detail in the zine, and we talk about actual capital gains. We talk about the stock indexes across the world are constantly making gains on war, on the military. This is what this machine that we live, you know, we're living in the belly of the beast, and this is what this machine is designed to do. And woe betide anyone who gets in the way of the bottom line.
Yeah, I think, you know, 70% of this country's profit is made off of consumer spending. That's a huge motivator to get people back to work. That has been the priority. And even, you know, folks who experienced quote unquote lockdown, people were still working. Essential workers, quote, were still working and bearing the brunt of the virus and continue to be on the front lines for this pandemic. So I think we can see who this government feels is worth protecting. And in the introduction, we say this phrase, we all breathe the same air. It's not a metaphor. We talk about the connections of aid workers, unmasked aid workers entering Gaza and bringing not just COVID, but also so many other viruses. And as people have maybe seen in the news recently, polio is making a resurgence. And again, we're seeing the withholding of vaccines, like the idea that Palestinians in Gaza would ever like experience the same kind of care when their hospitals are being destroyed and attacked and targeted. I think we're in a particularly interesting moment with Biden just testing positive for COVID. And we're seeing just like this misinformation multiplying. And it really wasn't that long ago when Biden announced the end of the pandemic. And we talk about this story in the zine too. It was at the Detroit Auto Show. And it feels really compelling to me to be thinking about that as like the seed of this unscientific moment in time where it's like where he's planting the idea that the pandemic has ended while just trying to be like, yeah, and also look at all these shiny cars. It's time to go get a new car. That is always what it's about. It's always like, what can we get you to buy? And please don't look behind the curtain because you don't want to see what's back there.
So, I mean, you say the pandemic is a part of a genocide in itself and a genocide that perpetuates all others. You've touched on some of the ways that happens. You also describe it as eugenics. And those are some pretty strong words.
Yeah, I think, you know, eugenics is a very big word. It can be scary if people feel like they're being accused of something. I think it's important to think about just the context of this settler colony and how eugenics has just been like at the core of our medical system at all times. I think we saw this in really stark contrast in early months of the pandemic when doctors were deciding who got to live and die and who got access to a ventilator and who did not. So often it's disabled folks, elderly folks, Black and Brown, Indigenous people who are being told that their lives are not worthy and someone else's life matters more. And we see that in pretty much every day that's being enacted in the United States, the settler colony. So I think when it comes to COVID, it's just making those connections of like, well, if this is a virus that's continuing to circulate and it causes long COVID, every single infection makes your immune system weaker. It damages every single organ in your body. As we talk a lot in the zine, the impacts of this virus are cumulative. If maybe the first time you got it, it felt mild, you're not really seeing what's happening on the inside of your body. And like we're also talking about the ruling class of this country, they're not experiencing the same things as workers. They're not experiencing, and even here in the global north, we're not experiencing the same things that folks in the global south, like Palestine, so many other places across the globe are experiencing. And so it just develops this hierarchy of not just who gets access to healthcare, but who just gets exposed to the virus more and viruses in general. And I would say an inspirational text for this is called The Viral Underclass by Stephen Thrasher. And he really talks about that layer of society in which folks are just predisposed to be exposed to viruses and all the complications that comes to and how it predisposes people to incarceration, to police violence, to early death, to cancer, all those kinds of things that we're also seeing in Gaza as well.
The line that you brought us in with was, it's also a genocide that perpetuates other genocides. And as Ramona just said, as you mentioned, polio is rearing its head again, also in Palestine, And that's another place where vaccines are being withheld, just as they were with COVID, by the occupying forces. As long as we in this country, with all of the information that we have and with all of the tools that we have, this could be stopped. It is a choice. It is, as we mentioned in the zine, this is a policy choice to let COVID run rampant throughout the globe. And it is a policy choice that makes all the other policy choices that much worse. There are IOF enactors who, IOF genocider, if you don't mind me reading this for just a second, openly described disease as a means to their desired end, declaring severe epidemics in the south of the Gaza Strip will bring victory closer. So we, Ramona and I, posit that where annihilation is the goal, death and disease are also welcome.
So what people hear protesting, boycotting, calling for divestment, calling for sanctions, calling for ceasefire, calling for an end to this genocide need to learn is, from your zine, is the connection that you're making and also the actions to be taken here. You have an extensive list of citations for your sources, which people can find online. And you have this informative, beautiful zine, which you're distributing free to mask blocks, organizers, encampments, but you also have a number of suggested price points for others, and with half the proceeds going to families in Gaza. Can you talk about how you made decisions about distributing the zine and making it available, helping get the word out in different kinds of ways?
Something that we learned with our first zine, COVID is a Labor Issue, is that we were getting downloads and folks were printing this out, putting zines at bus stops, in little free libraries, at free fridges, and we were getting downloads from all over the world. And that has continued with this project. It's been really exciting. We've had downloads in Lebanon, we've had downloads in Malaysia, in France, across the UK, folks in South America. This has really traveled, and it's really amazing how this project really isn't possible without the disseminators, the folks who are really getting this information out to communities. And we're getting emails every day from people who are sharing at their mutual aid fairs, sharing with their co-organizers, doing study groups, using this as a tool to create stricter COVID precautions to protect more people. So I would say, in terms of sliding scale, you know, we are also independent artists. And so we do keep a little bit of the funds in order to support ourselves and create more projects, because there are always more projects coming down the line. And then also, I think a huge part of this is that it is a tool for fundraising, and that there are people who are begging right now for funds from people whose tax dollars are paying for the genocide. Like, that must be front and center, is like ultimately one of the most impactful things we could do is just not fund this genocide. But given the current circumstances, we are trying our hardest to support families who are in this death camp and trying to survive and help their families survive, especially folks in diaspora who are desperately trying to support their families right now. So Sham, do you want to kind of share about the work that you've been doing?
Yeah, we've been using the zine for fundraising for a project called Creators for Gaza, which started here locally. Really, it feels like a long time ago, but it was only in April, May. And someone in our community happened to share on social media a family that they were fundraising for, that, you know, it was somebody directly in our community. When I learned about this family, I was inspired to create an illustration that kind of drew attention to their GoFundMe. There were so many GoFundMes, and it felt like maybe just one way that I could kind of lend a little bit of attention to one particular campaign that I was personally connected to. And with the help of that illustration that then got a little more traction, we brought more creators in, and I kind of like roped in all my illustrator friends. And now we are supporting about 40 families who are in Gaza, who are either trying to evacuate or are trying to stay and rebuild. Either way, they are trying to survive, you know, these conditions at the moment. We're all very connected. We talk to them daily. We have, like I said, about 40 families that we're supporting. We have helped to, alhamdulillah, evacuate multiple family members, multiple families. And we are just really grateful and honored to know and to get to know and to get to tell the stories and amplify the stories of these people who, like Ramona said at the very beginning, at the top of this, feel like a world away, but they are our families. And this world is so tiny. Also, like you said, we breathe the same air. Somebody can get on a flight and, you know, land anywhere. And that is whatever you take, that air that you have taken with you. We're all so connected. And the zine, we also highly encourage people to download the zine and use it for 100% fundraising, because that has been hugely helpful. And we also welcome people to join our community, our global community of amplifiers, whether you are an artist or whether you just want to get involved and to get to know people who are caring about some of the same things that you are.
We'll put up links to your websites when we post the show on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. But tell us where people can find more information, the zine, more about your other projects.
Yeah, we have all of these projects available on our websites. My website, this is Ramona Escayo. You can find me at rimoskyo.com and also on Instagram at rimo_skyo. And we have everything linked and all the work that we make is available for free.
My links are shamgheeth.com, shamgheeth.com. On Instagram, I am at shamgheeth, same spelling. And our Creators for Gaza is on Instagram, Creators for Gaza. And the website there is creatorsforgaza.quarto.pub/the-list/. It's a long one. We'll put it in the notes.
Thank you so much for your work, for your beautiful zine. And people should be checking that out. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
That was a snippet of Life During Wartime by the Talking Heads, remastered in 2003. Before that, Ramona Escayo and Shyam Gheeth talked with me about Palestinian solidarity and COVID-19. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We turn now from the history of Palestine, its colonization, and the possibilities of solidarity to another angle on the history of U.S. military involvements. Here is Laurie Mercier talking with historian Osama Khalil about his book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden.
Good morning. I'm speaking with Osama Khalil about his new book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden. Khalil is chair of the International Relations Program and senior research associate of the Middle Eastern Studies Program at Syracuse University. Among other publications, he's the author of America's Dream Palace, Middle East Expertise and the Rise of the National Security State, which was named by Foreign Affairs as a best book of 2017. He's been a frequent contributor to various media, including the Huffington Post, Los Angeles Times, The Hill, Al Akbar, and Al Jazeera. Welcome to KBOO, Osama Khalil.
Thanks, Laurie. Happy to be here.
Well, your book offers a masterful historical overview of U.S. foreign policy since the war in Vietnam. Why do you begin your story with the Kennedy administration in Vietnam, and how have the so-called lessons of Vietnam continued to influence policymakers in ways that don't indicate any lessons have been learned?
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and it's also a great question, and it's one I struggled with when I was writing the book about where to start the story. And, you know, there are several starting points one could pick, particularly in the post-World War II era. And what I decided was that the Kennedy presidency, and of course then the Kennedy assassination, has a profound impact on American society and American political culture. And what's interesting about it is we have, you know, Kennedy's soaring inaugural address that inspires a whole generation of baby boomers, many who will go into government service inspired by that inaugural address, and then will be forced in different agencies, State Department, CIA, Defense, et cetera, and will then be faced with the Vietnam War. And that will become their key testing ground. And what I described in the book and what I came to see was that many of those key figures would stay in these different agencies, whether they stayed in the Foreign Service or in and out of government, would return to the Vietnam War experience for better or worse. They didn't always draw the same conclusions from the war, but invariably they kept coming back to that experience and applying it to different conflicts over the next six decades. The other aspect of the Kennedy presidency, I think that's interesting, that I can talk a little more about specifically on Vietnam, is, you know, Kennedy is going to put in several different attempts at several things in Vietnam that will have long-term implications. One, not just for his presidency, but then after the assassination, President Johnson, and then President Nixon. And that includes counterinsurgency initiatives. It includes, you know, the overthrow and assassination of the U.S. ally, Ngo Dinh Diem, the president of South Vietnam, all of which have long-range implications for America's involvement in Vietnam, and leaves, you know, a really difficult challenge for Johnson and Nixon to deal with. And as I argue in the book, they don't really deal with it well. There's also attempts to then contain, as the Vietnam War is failing, to contain its impact globally, not just in Southeast Asia, not just even the countries, you know, neighboring Vietnam, but across what we now call the Global South, but the Third World. And I look at some of those test cases, those case studies rather, in the Middle East, Southern Africa, and Latin America. The other aspect, and this is a thread through the book, is the role of decline. And so this is something that differentiates, for example, the Korean War from the Vietnam. Even though the Korean War ends in a stalemate, if not an American loss, it doesn't have this impact on the American psyche. In fact, you know, at the end of the Eisenhower presidency, you could argue America believed, and American policymakers viewed America's place in the world as unbounded, had not been impacted by the Korean War in any substantial way. In fact, what we see is that some of the aspects of what was attempted in the Korean War are brought into Vietnam and other conflicts. Vietnam is quite different. And instead, what we see is an existential crisis, for lack of a better term. That's effectively what we see by the 1970s, the post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, post-Kennedy assassinations, as well as the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and other key figures. Then, you know, you can compare it to how the baby boomers were inspired by Kennedy and are now, in a sense, view the America's place in the world quite differently. And the question that comes about in the 70s, and we'll see it again in the 80s at the end of the Reagan presidency, we'll see it again in the 90s. I talk about it by 2008 and then the Trump presidency, again and again, the idea that America is in decline. And whether it's real or perceived, it has a profound impact. And we can trace that to an effect, and I do in the book, to the Vietnam era.
But you also argue that domestic and foreign policies are closely intertwined, which is something most Americans don't really think about. I mean, sadly, most Americans don't think about foreign policy or pay attention to what the United States is doing around the world. What are some of the links you make between the wars on terror, drugs, and crime?
It's a great question. So the way we as scholars and historians tend to view these spheres, the domestic sphere and the foreign policy sphere, as separate and distinct. And I dealt with a little bit of this in my first book, and I wanted to come back to it more in this book, which is to look at how they influence each other. How do domestic politics and domestic policy influence foreign policy? How have they been exported on things like crime, drugs, and terror? And how have those wars come back home? How has foreign policy come back home and then influenced domestic policy? So that's a key thread through the book. So one of the things we'll see, for example, and this will be intuitive to your readers, which is that crime and drugs are often linked, right? And so what we'll see, though, is that the war on crime is directly linked to the Vietnam War. So here's a case where you have the Vietnam War coming home in Johnson's announcement of a war on crime. But many of those policies which become amplified over the next six decades. And so what I trace out is also this idea of the very real reality of militarized policing at home that's connected to a militarized foreign policy abroad. and that these influence each other. And so we can trace the militarized policing to the Johnson administration. And then, of course, the war on drugs. And we could, you have several different starting points for the war on drugs that you could trace to the post-World War II era, to prohibition, et cetera. Where I pick up, of course, is Johnson and Nixon, and in particular, Nixon, and him taking a lot of that kind of prohibition era focus on the war on drugs and really amplifying. And it's Nixon who's going to become the template, particularly for other Republican presidents like Reagan, like Bush, but not just, because we also see with Bill Clinton, a Democrat who fully embraces Nixon's law and order approach, amplifies the war on crime, amplifies the war on drugs. And what your listeners may also not realize is that how the U.S. dealt with terror, both abroad and at home, and we have, and I described the several different mini wars on terror that occurred before 9/11, but the terror was often at home dealt with as a criminal justice issue, and that that is abandoned after 9/11. It becomes fully militarized. And at the same time, through these mini wars on terror that we see under Nixon, under Reagan, and then again, as it picks up after 9/11, is a fully militarized response in which diplomacy is not the priority. Instead, what we're seeing is, we're still learning much more about this than I could get to in the book, about the types of interventions that the U.S. was conducting, including using special forces or a combination of special forces teams with CIA to combat quote-unquote terrorist organizations overseas as they were defined by the U.S. So these three interlink. And what we see is the impact also, for example, when we think about crime and narcotics, the use of how important things like informants are, and in cases where they may or may not be credible informants. And we see that again with the war on terror. We see that in the response to 9/11, how the Bush administration and the Bush Justice Department is so eager to find victories in the war on terror at home, that we'll see the use of unscrupulous informants. We'll see the use of high profile cases that end up being much less than they are initially, you know, depicted to the press, with these grand indictments, you know, 400 count indictments of professors, of charities. And then it turns out that there's not really a lot there. So those are some of the things I tease out in the book. And I think will also, I think, surprise your readers. There are other aspects that, for example, have been erased from history, the Abu Ghraib scandal. And this provides us a direct link between how we've dealt with the war on crime at home, mass incarceration, so both crime and drugs and mass incarceration, and then the impact of that on foreign policy. So for your listeners who may not remember or may not know about the Abu Ghraib scandal, Abu Ghraib was one of the notorious prisons in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. It becomes an American prison after the U.S. invasion and occupation. And then a deliberate decision is made at the Guantanamo Bay prison, at the Bagram Air Base prison in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and several black sites, that the U.S. quote unquote needs to get tough with the detainees. This is how you break the insurgencies, the global insurgencies, as it's being described, the global jihad. And in Iraq, what's happening at Abu Ghraib is some 80%, we come to find out, of the prisoners were not tied to this emerging and growing insurgency in Iraq. In fact, they were, you know, petty criminals. Some of them weren't involved in anything. And this is a case where, again, we'll see this in Afghanistan and Iraq, what becomes known effectively as a bounty, right? So what is the United States doing? U.S. military, U.S. intelligence been offering bounties for anyone who can give information on a potential member of the insurgency. And so, of course, if you have a grudge, if you have some kind of issue with another individual, if you just want the money, you're turning over individuals and they're getting arrested. So the decision is made now to be tough on the detainees.
It seems kind of reminiscent of U.S. policies in general.
Oh, sure.
The torture proven to be ineffective. I mean, doesn't end in any kind of results that might be desired, but yet torture is continued to be used, and these interventions over and over again don't achieve anything that's useful to the United States, but yet policymakers continue to intervene in just about every corner of the globe. I wanted to ask about the two main sections of your book. You frame your narrative within these two categories, the firefighters and the Badlands. Do you want to say something about why you decided to frame this history within these categories?
Sure. And I think it's a great question. So the first half, which deals with the Cold War, so that the Vietnam War to the end of the Reagan presidency, is under the part one of the firemen. And this is based on a Kennedy speech regarding Vietnam. So one of the things I'm looking at there is this perception, this self-perception that the United States is out fighting fires, right? These Cold War era fires that are popping up around the globe. And they're often doing it without, as Kennedy will describe, kind of haphazardly out, you know, really the thanks of those countries that the United States has intervened in part because they're so shell-shocked by this interventions that occurred. And this is, you know, his own description that he will give at a pro-Vietnam group that's bipartisan, that's opposed to the division of Vietnam into two countries, that becomes known as the Geneva Accord. So what I look at there is the United States' interventions really also related to the Vietnam War in the sense that they're attempting to contain the impact of the Vietnam War. And what I argue in there is that the United States also serves to entrench these conflicts throughout the Cold War. So whether that is in Southeast Asia, it's in South Asia, it's in the Middle East, it's in Latin America, Southern Africa, that there were other options available. And I discussed those. You know, Southern Africa, as I described, is a great example. The Middle East is another great example of where the United States could have, in fact, should have, adopted a different approach and didn't. And so that's part one. In part two, with the Badlands, what I then talk about is how the United States looked at these urban areas, its own domestic urban areas, and described them and unwillingness to deal with key issues related to social problems and related to that crime, drugs, mental health issues, et cetera, and has started to define by the 80s and 90s these urban areas as Badlands. Now, some of this takes us back to the Prohibition era, because that's where this term was first applied, drawing on the myth and the mythology of the American West, and then applying it to places like the South Side of Chicago during the Capone era. And then we see it reemerge in the 90s with the war on drugs, and then is transported abroad with the war on terror. So many of those same conflict zones I described in the Cold War, those conflicts have become entrenched. They haven't been resolved. And then by the post-Cold War era, especially the war on terror, these Badlands are now overseas in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Gaza. And again, part of this is about an unwillingness, much like there's an unwillingness to deal with America's urban problems, to deal with these problems overseas, other than through military means or through militarized policing. So the Badlands, in effect, kind of blend this idea about domestic policy and foreign policy and their implications, and how much we see not just the policies that are being exported, but how we view those populations. How do you view a population that lives in the Badlands?
And it does seem like race and racism really undergird policies within the United States and abroad.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I try and trace out, is how much those perceptions of race, religious supremacy, or racial and religious inferiority are also influencing policymakers, how they view not just domestic arenas, but the arenas overseas. And so it becomes really difficult to distinguish between the quote-unquote global South or the third world during the Cold War, as well as America's urban areas. And we see that playing out, which is why the book ends with Biden, because we see it tracing out across 6 to 7 decades, if not earlier.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm speaking with Professor Osama Khalil about his important new book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden. So how is war so embedded in the U.S. economy, culture, and politics, but so invisible?
The book was completed before October 7th, but we've seen it really on full display since October 7th. For example, Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, is asked, you know, immediately after the October 7th attacks, can the United States afford to support wars in Ukraine and Israel? And without missing a beat, she says, absolutely. I think it's been demonstrated, if you look at how President Biden has talked about the need for foreign assistance to Ukraine and Israel, and the fact that the Wall Street Journal, which agrees with President Biden on very little, if anything, absolutely agrees with him that foreign military assistance comes back to the United States in the form of jobs. So if you were to ask Americans today, are we at war? They would say no. In fact, President Biden just said this, proud to be the first American president to say we're not at war today. And yet the United States is active in 5 different war zones right now, whether it's Gaza, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Iraq. The United States is active in Ukraine. The United States has special forces operations throughout the world, whether it's training or active kinetic operations. It has troops stationed in South Korea. It has a flotilla of naval ships, not only in and around the Persian Gulf and the Eastern Mediterranean, but in the Pacific. And yet, Americans are told they're not at war. And yet, they're actively deployed. Part of this also has to do with the fact that we have a volunteer military, and we have since the end of the Vietnam War. And so the footprint of it's very small. And the number of families that are impacted, we saw this during the Afghanistan and Iraq, is small, but it's profound, the impact of these conflicts. And you touched on in the beginning that Americans aren't really paying attention. And in fact, that's what policymakers want. As I talk about in the book, there's also, this is again tied to these issues of race and racism, which is the demonization of the other that occurs. So Americans are constantly being told that they're faced this world of enemies, including some at home, and a world of enemies abroad. And that is, and then how we describe those populations, again, whether they live in the Badlands or not, also feeds into these policies and this perpetual war machine.
So there's this demonization of individuals like Saddam Hussein or Vladimir Putin, and then we have faceless terrorists such as those in Lebanon or Hamas, without any kind of legitimate goals or causes that they might champion.
Sure. Well, once you label a group as terrorist, then it's completely delegitimized, right? That delegitimizes any claim that they may have. I think you've heard this a lot since October 7th. I think the other aspect I would, you know, really want your readers to think, or your listeners to think about, is the following, which is, how is it that Americans are told over and over again, we can't afford this, we can't afford that, we can't afford universal health care, we can't afford universal daycare, universal access to higher education, retirement, etc., but we can afford a $300 million fake pier that was built off of Gaza that provided very little humanitarian aid. It was essentially a prop for a special forces operation, right, in which 300 Palestinians were killed, an untold number of Israeli hostages were killed before Israeli hostages were rescued. And the reality there, and this is what I talk about in the book, is that we've allowed diplomacy to be completely enervated. And because you've allowed diplomacy to be deprioritized and enervated, it allows for this kind of militarized foreign policy, militarized humanitarian assistance, and the use of these kinds of props. Those hostages could have been released through negotiations. But that was something that the United States either didn't want to do or was unwilling to pay the price, the public relations price of those negotiations. And so I think what's also important here for the listeners to understand is that this also is related to, we talk about deprioritizing foreign policy, is America's insistence now on conflict management over conflict resolution. And so in many of these key areas I talk about in those badlands, what the United States is no longer interested in is actual conflict resolution. It wants to manage these conflicts, kick the can down the road, and let it become somebody else's problem. If they can't deal with it in a military way, then, and they're afraid that diplomacy is going to be too difficult, too many concessions. And so this is, again, that tie back to the Vietnam era, where the United States sought not negotiations with North Vietnam, but North Vietnamese surrender. And that was supposed to be done through the application of military force. And what I talk about is how we see those same applications again and again, and it's happening again today in Gaza.
Well, you point out that the United States has already spent more than $6 trillion on the war on terror and at least $1 trillion on the war on drugs. And there's no accounting for the costs on various countries and societies that have been destroyed and communities within the United States. But yet these fruitless policies of global interventions and wars and militarizing police and drug wars at home at such costs, but the United States continues, policymakers continue these practices. So why won't the United States pursue alternatives such as diplomacy or addiction treatment?
I think one of the issues that we, and I talk about this in the book, and this is again the influence of domestic politics, where, you know, part of it's about a domestic political cycle, you know, the 2-year, 4-year cycle. The belief, when we talk about how crime has been applied to both drugs and terror, being tough on crime, tough on drugs, tough on terror, is often seen as a requirement for political office. The belief that this is what the American public wants to hear and reassures them. And as I talk about in the book, particularly at the end, we've seen this cycle again and again when it comes to the, you know, for example, midterm elections, how the threat of crime, the threat of a migrant horde, the threat of these different constant threats are used in particular, and it's not just Republicans, but are used by different political figures and candidates to really amplify their get tough approach. And so that's one aspect of this. The other aspect, as I talk about, is we have had, and we've seen this with the militarized foreign policy, is that you can trace out a series of, you know, war hawk secretaries of state. And this seems to be a requirement that you have to be tough as a secretary of state, right? And that's not the role of the secretary of state. That's America's chief diplomat. And yet what we've seen is, whether it's Dean Rusk in Vietnam or it's Hillary Clinton under Obama, or it's Anthony Blinken today, or Condoleezza Rice, for example, under the Bush, in the Bush administration, this idea that diplomacy and the military are going hand in glove, right? And that they can, that we can't separate these, that diplomacy is not good, if anything, is rarely a carrot anymore, but is just a less blunt stick. And so standing behind diplomacy is this force of the American military. But as I talk about in the book, that's also tied to these perceptions of decline, because as the United States continues to intervene abroad, when it doesn't get the result that it thinks it's going to get through military force, or that it has promised the American public, it adds into this perception of decline. And then what that also does is it's the paradox, the belief that more force is needed instead of less force. And a great example of that is occurring right now in Yemen with U.S. airstrikes. And there's a moment back in January when the United States launched airstrikes against Ansar Allah, the Houthi movement, in which President Biden is asked, are the airstrikes working? And he will say, are the airstrikes working? Do you mean that they are deterring the Houthis? No, they're not. Will they continue? Yes. And that fundamentally sums up U.S. foreign policy, at least for the past three decades, I would argue, taking us back to the Vietnam era. Because that's precisely the same kind of logic that drove, for example, in Vietnam, Operation Rolling Thunder, which was the bombing campaign of North Vietnam, which then continued to escalate from 1965 to 68, 69. And the idea there was, quote unquote, make North Vietnam beg for peace. And when that didn't work, what do? Bomb them harder. And instead of looking at what's at the root cause, and in part, one of the other aspects we've seen, this is part of the political culture in Washington, whether it's Vietnam in under Johnson, or Iraq under the Bush administration, or Gaza today, alternate voices are not being listened to within the bureaucracy. In fact, they're deliberately shut out. That was the case under Johnson. That was the case under Bush. That's the case today with Biden.
Well, what about the role of the military-industrial complex behind all this? Isn't there some kind of material economic incentive for continuing and promoting wars?
Well, absolutely. And I touch on a little bit on that in the book. It's something I'm working on in a subsequent project. And then the question is, of course, and this ties back to the point I made earlier about President Biden fully promoting it, this idea that foreign military assistance comes home in the form of American jobs as part of why war is so invisible to most Americans, because they benefit from it on a daily basis. They benefit from it. If you have, if you have a pension plan, if you have a 401k, chances are you have investments in any index fund in any of the major military contractors, right? And so you benefit from it without really even knowing it. That doesn't even include those few Americans who actually invest directly in the stock market, invest directly in these military contractors, whether it's Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or any number. And so there's also those dual use companies, right? So something like SpaceX, right, which is fully reliant on government contracts. So we have had that deeply embedded in the U.S. economy and has been since the post-World War II era. Gun manufacturing, the United States is the main gun manufacturer in the world and has been since the World War I era, right, in terms of the export of guns abroad. So this is one of those things that's deeply built into the U.S. economy, but it's also built in political culture, whether it's video games, Call of Duty, on down, any number of TV shows and movies that are produced. We talked about torture. And so even though torture hasn't been effective, it is presented as effective in any number of pop culture products, whether it's movies or TV shows. And I talk a little bit about that in the book, which is the exact opposite of what we're seeing. But it offers Americans this kind of idea that, oh, if there is this thorny problem, we can just torture the guy or woman and get the answer we need. And yet we've seen that doesn't work at all. So this is one of those aspects where when we think about the military-industrial complex, what's also important about it is just how pervasive it is in the United States, in the sense of where are these companies located, where are the factories located, and they're often located in key districts, and that's deliberate. So how do you get congressmen or congresswomen, representatives on board, or key senators? Well, there's jobs in their districts. There's jobs in their states. And so once again, we see this as pervasive throughout the system and tied into American political culture and the American political calendar.
Well, just to wrap up here, Osama Khalil, you write a lot about the importance of diplomacy and advocating for diplomacy as solutions to wars abroad, and instead of militarizing the police, other kinds of alternatives with the drug wars, looking at treatment for addiction rather than punishment. What about grassroots groups and their mobilizations in terms of bringing about a shift in U.S. foreign policy and other bad policies within the United States? I mean, what are ways in which we can shift this paradigm?
That's a great question. And it's a huge challenge. I think we're seeing some of that with this election. And I think you saw some of that with the grassroots movement around an uncommitted vote to send some kind of message back to the Biden campaign, the Biden White House, that the policy, for example, in the Middle East needs to change. And grassroots is really important, but it's also, as we know, really limited. Why? Again, back to the political calendar and the very reality, and we're seeing it with this presidential campaign, of the vast amounts of money that are coming into the campaigns from wealthy individuals, from wealthy corporations, that's completely unchecked. So the power of grassroots individuals is in mobilizing and challenging those vast sums of money. You won't get equal weight. And we've seen that in the Democratic Party. I think we've seen that with this, with what's about to happen with the convention, which is, in fact, to kind of cut out the role of activists and grassroots movements, has decided to go with a virtual nomination process. So we're seeing democracy being diminished day by day at the same time that we're being told that democracy is on the ballot. And also watching this massive amount of donor money that's coming in and what they may want. So the Peter Thiels of the world or the Miriam Adelsons who are funneling a lot of money into the Trump campaign, or on the other side, your Haim Sabans and other wealthy individuals, Jeffrey Katzenberg, et cetera, what they may want is not exactly what the average voter may want.
Yeah, or AIPAC just defeating Cori Bush and really targeting all of those who have just voiced some opposition to Israel's genocide.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Osama Khalil. We'll link to your book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden, on the Old Mole Variety Hour website. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Transmit the message to the receiver. Hope for an answer someday. I got three passports, a couple of visas. You don't even know my
That was a snippet of Life During Wartime by the Talking Heads, remastered in 2005. And before that, Laurie Mercier and historian Osama Khalil discussing the U.S. government's continuing investments in war abroad and at home. I'm Fran Michel, and you have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Remember, you can support your volunteer-powered, member-supported, non-commercial community radio station by texting KBOO to 44321. Thanks to Ramona Escayo and Shyam Geith for talking with me about their work on Palestinian solidarity and COVID-19. Thanks to Laurie Mercier and her guest, Osama Khalil, for their conversation about his book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden. Thanks to Desiree Helligers and Patricia Kullberg for behind-the-scenes help. And thanks to Joe Clement for performing our theme song. You can find more information about our show and the segments, as well as a link to register for the Veterans for Peace Convention coming up online Friday through Sunday, August 16 to 18, by visiting our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. While you're there, you can support this show and all the great KBOO programming by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner. The Old Mole will be back next Monday. Stay tuned now for Locus Focus. We'll go out with some of the 2023 remaster of the live version of Life During Wartime by the Talking Heads.
Heard about Houston, heard about Detroit, heard about Pittsburgh, PA. You ought to know not to stand by the window. Somebody see you up there. I got some groceries, some peanut butter to last a couple of days. But I ain't got no speakers. Ain't got no headphones, ain't got no records to play. Wasn't in college, why go to night school? But I'm a dip in the sky. Can't write a letter, can't send a postcard. I can't write nothing at all. This ain't no party, this ain't no disco. Oh,
got through the roadblock. We blended in with the crowd. We got computers, we're tapping phone lines. Know that that ain't allowed. We dress like students, we dress like housewives, or in a suit and a tie. Changed my hairstyle so many times now. What I look like. You make me shiver, I feel so tender. We make a pretty good team.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communication